I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, Governor Greg Abbott has deployed Texas National Guard troops to San Antonio as the city prepares for two downtown anti-government protests. San Antonio Mayor Ron Nuremberg nor SAPD Chief William McManus were consulted or informed on the arrival of the troops, and they have not been in contact with Abbott or the Guard about their presence. We hear from Nuremberg about his concerns and his call for cooler heads during the upcoming protests. And later on The Source, during turbulent times, it's an advantage to have a basic grasp of economics and finance. Terms like inflation, treasury bonds, recession, and modern monetary theory are bandied about in the news. But what do they mean, and why do they matter to your personal finances? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source. But first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking about economics, and being financially literate is necessary these days. But first, Governor Greg Abbott has deployed the Texas National Guard to San Antonio. There are at least two anti-government peaceful protests planned for downtown tonight and on Saturday. This is the first time in modern memory that a governor has sent the National Guard to San Antonio. Earlier today, I spoke with San Antonio Mayor Ron Nuremberg about the protest and the presence of the National Guard.
The city, as well as SAPD specifically, support people's right to peacefully assemble and to protest and to speak out. And PD's primary responsibility is to make sure people can exercise that right safely.
You have also indicated that you sympathize with some of the frustrations that the protesters have. Can you talk about that?
Well, absolutely. The federal government has displayed its cruelty and amidst a very crude interpretation of immigration law. And it has, in my opinion, cruelty is kind of the point, particularly with regard to human rights. And so I can empathize with people who feel that way. I feel that way myself. There's serious fatigue in the way this federal administration is handling these difficult issues. But I also want to reinforce the fact that the chief is there to protect people and also urge people to remain peaceful if they choose to demonstrate. We have full faith in our police department and in the relationship they have with our community, and I have full confidence that the San Antonio community can maintain peace and order in the process. It's been our tradition, and we've been an example of how to do things right over many, many decades.
So given that people are frustrated, they may be angry about the policies of the Trump administration in many areas, if they do not protest peacefully, if they act out, do property destruction or engage violently with law enforcement or the National Guard, I mean, would that, you think, would be playing into the narrative that Donald Trump is trying to exploit or create?
100% agree with that. Destruction and bodily harm are never appropriate. And, you know, if that's the result of the demonstrations, then the message gets lost. The message should be very clear about the opposition to the federal government's approach and many of its policies. And so we are respectful of the people's rights to speak out and to demonstrate. And I hope that message gets delivered. But I also hope it is done peacefully, because if it isn't, then the message won't be received. The message won't get delivered. And so, you know, exercise your right to free speech, but I urge you to keep it peaceful and lawful, and we're going to be there to protect everyone.
The Governor Greg Abbott, he has deployed Texas National Guard troops to San Antonio as a precautionary measure to deal with these protests. How have you been in contact with the governor's office about what's happening?
I have not. We have reached out on multiple occasions. We've not gotten any information directly, but law enforcement has communicated, and confirmed, obviously the presence of guardsmen.
Right, and the governor's office has also released a statement confirming that they have sent these troops to San Antonio.
Right.
So that's official. We know that. The fact that we had to find that out through these back channels, how does that sit?
It's frustrating. I think, look, our communities work better when we're working together towards common goals. And I believe everyone's goal is to maintain safety and order. We disagree on the policies, and we also probably disagree on the importance of the message being sent by protesters. But as it relates to public safety, we agree people need to be safe. And I would tell anyone listening, including the governor, that we have the best police department in the country. We have demonstrated repeatedly we know how to protect our own, and they can maintain order. And I have full faith and confidence in them to do that. I also have faith and confidence in the San Antonio community to demonstrate peacefully.
Have you seen anything in these recent street protests that have happened around San Antonio, around downtown, that would indicate the need for the National Guard?
No. And, the scenes playing out in L.A. are disturbing, to say the least. We've seen that kind of scene in other parts of the country, but it's evident to me, at least the Trump administration's intent is to continue to escalate the situation. That's not what we do here.
So normally we would expect that the governor would be in contact with the mayor and with the police chief, and that there would be some coordination and discussion about how to maximize the use of resources to minimize any kind of public disruption. And that's not happening. Is that correct?
It's not happening, but, when there is, need for law enforcement coordination, those things are usually done at the law enforcement level. So, when there's communication on a message, then that's where we get multiple jurisdictions at our level involved. But this is a law enforcement activity at this point. And, it is frustrating that we didn't get any advance notification. But I do trust that our chief has good relationships across the board on these things, and hopefully we will, again, maintain the peace, stay coordinated, and SAPD will be able to handle that just fine.
Is the Texas National Guard trained for these types of events?
That's a question for the command of the Guard.
And we've seen what's happened in other cities like Austin, Dallas, L.A., they have erupted. Do you think that people are going to look at that and see this is what we need to do? How do you change that narrative?
Well, I think the only way to change that narrative is that we demonstrate how to do things right, which we have done in San Antonio. I do understand there's probably concern that things might devolve. And, we want to make sure that people are able to exercise their right to protest and to assemble. That's a very important right, and it's important that we speak out against the cruelty of the administration. But we've got to do that in a way that, protects people from harm.
Will you be going out there? Will you be participating in these protests?
I'm not sure yet.
What are you weighing? I mean, do you think that your presence could be a calming force? Could tell people to rein back?
Well, we're making sure that we deliver the right message in the right place and make the right preparations. So that's the focus right now. I'll think about those things later.
That was San Antonio Mayor Ron Nuremberg addressing the need for upcoming protests to remain peaceful and the unrequested presence of the Texas National Guard deployed to San Antonio by Governor Greg Abbott. When we come back from the break, we discuss how being economically literate can be an advantage during turbulent times. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, back in 1 minute.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Is now a good time to buy a house or sell a house, start a business, or take all of your life savings and put it into some meme crypto? It helps to have a grasp of the basics of economic trends before making life-changing mega investments. But if you aren't fluent in economics, that can be tough. And even understanding the news and politics requires a basic understanding of the economy. It can help you to make sense of the world and also save you some heartache. David A. Meyer joins us. His new book is Economics in Plain English. And David, welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having me.
So, David, when you listen to the news, do you hear a lot of economic terms?
As much as we talk about unemployment, inflation, tariffs, treasuries, defaults, all of those things that are front and center in the news, primarily in financial news, but also on just mainstream news, you hear a lot of terminology being thrown around.
Yeah, but they don't really ever kind of back it up and explain, you know, hey, we're treasury bills are crashing or soaring or whatever. They don't tell you what those things are.
Right. And that's a problem for the listener who isn't quite sure, or maybe they have a pseudo concept of, okay, I think I know what this means. And that can lead to some real misunderstanding.
Right. Yeah. So we hear all the time now about the word recession gets thrown around quite a bit. Like there's a recession coming or it's not coming or what. So why is a recession, what does it mean? Why is it so scary?
Well, so recessions are periods of slow growth or no growth or even negative growth accompanied by above average high unemployment. So recessions, we typically don't know we are in one until we've been in one. And it's been going on for a while. The problem with recession, of course, is that when you have high rates of unemployment, that has a real impact on those people who lose their jobs and their families. And so recession is important to understand. But I think it's one of those things that's also often misunderstood. The ability to just predict recession or say we are right now in a recession, very hard to predict because most of the data we use to understand whether or not a recession is taking place is lagging data. That is, we are looking through the rearview mirror and trying to get a idea of what's going on in the present.
And so that's why it's misunderstood. People may say we're in a recession based upon their gut instinct or some indicator, but like hemlines and stuff like that.
right. Like how often men are replacing their underwear is one of the indicators that Alan Greenspan came up with. So whether or not we are actually in recession is not something that you can just declare, right? I mean, it because a lot of times your, your own, what's happening in your own life is what's really informing that declaration. And in economics, we look at things in the aggregate, you know, so it's beyond what our personal experience is, but really trying to combine data from a bunch of different sources so that the bias is not individual, but instead trying to kind of eliminate that bias by looking at data from a large data set.
And it helps to know if we're in a recession or about to enter one, if you're planning to do something like open a business or make a big economic change. So a lot of people are always looking around the corner to see, are we in one? So if you open up a new business and you're relying on people having surplus income, that there's going to be robust employment, and then the economy hits the skids, then you're going to lose out. So it helps to know the terms and have an idea of what these trends are. And I guess that's why, but you know, it seemed like economists use these terms in a way different than the way that politicians and the way newscasters use them as well.
Yes. So when economists speak, they have a solid understanding of the terminology and how it's used. For example, unemployment. The term unemployment to an economist is it's a very precise definition. It means that you are part of the labor force, but you're not currently working, nor have you worked in the last 2 weeks, but you're also currently applying for unemployment benefits, or you're completing job applications. So it's a very, you know, defined term. Whereas for most people, they would equate unemployment with just being jobless. But there's many more people who are jobless who are not unemployed, because we don't really know why they're jobless. And so it's that misunderstanding that takes place, because people don't generally understand what the definitions actually mean.
So if you have quit the economy, you've been looking for a job, you haven't found anything, and now you're just doing something like mowing lawns on your own, you're not, you know, on the underground economy, maybe you would not be counted as jobless.
You would be jobless because if you're mowing lawns, you're working. So you have a job. To have a job does not necessarily mean to be employed by someone else. Right. But the main idea I'm trying to get across is that just because someone is jobless, literally not working, does not mean that they're unemployed. Those are two different things.
Well, I've seen the unemployment number go up because people have re-entered the economy. They've been on the sidelines for a long time, say like during the pandemic or what have you.
Yes.
Then things got brighter and they said, okay, now's a good time for me to get back in the economy. And even though it seemed like overall the economy was improving, but unemployment went up, which is typically a negative indicator.
Right. In the example that you share, where all of a sudden people start entering into the labor market and applying for jobs, because that's how you enter into the labor market, is you complete applications for employment. So that picks up at the end of a long recession. And so it is not unusual at all to see the unemployment rate rise, because as more people join the labor force, the proportion of those people who aren't currently hired yet is relatively higher than it was during the depths of a recession, when people may have just given up the job search altogether and dropped out of the labor force.
I'm going to play a clip here. This is from this morning at the House Ways and Means Committee hearing. It has Congresswoman Linda Sanchez, a Democrat from California, interacting with Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent. And there's a lot of back and forth here, and it's confrontational, but we hear a lot of economic terms. Let's give a listen.
Mr. Secretary, do you still believe that the president's tariffs are going to be a one-time price adjustment for American families?
If prices go up, they will be one time.
Okay, well, unfortunately, you appear to be talking out of both sides of your mouth, because you yourself have admitted, after conversations with Walmart, that some tariff costs are going to get passed on to consumers. And in fact, we've already seen that prices are rising on many everyday goods.
Congresswoman,
please
today,
don't interrupt
today
me.
We had
the time is mine.
Increase.
The time is mine. Please don't interrupt
and,
me.
And
I will ask you questions, and I will grant you an opportunity to answer them, but please don't interrupt me during my time.
With pleasure.
Okay, I know I'm a woman, but please try to limit yourself to answering my questions. No, I'm sorry, but we get talked over all the time, and I don't want that to happen at this hearing.
I would remind members, the gentlelady is recognized. Please proceed.
Thank you. The time is mine. Clothing is going up 20%. Shoe prices and canned goods like chicken noodle soup and canned fruit and microwave meals have gone up 15%. Toys are getting more expensive. Walmart just raised the prices of dinosaur action figures by 38% and baby born dolls by 43%. Household goods like drills, toolkits, vacuums have also gone up. Stanley Black & Decker recently announced higher prices for all of their products, and these are just some of the products that are affected. On average, Trump's tariffs are estimated to cost households $3,000 more for the same goods than they would have last year. And that's money that could
That's incorrect. And
that is
I'm not sure who's estimated.
The best estimates are that consumers will pay $3,000 more for the same goods.
And that estimate is from
that
whom?
They did last year.
That estimate's from whom?
I will get you the estimates.
Right, because
but that's
C,
money
C,
that
the,
but
the
that's
CBO
money that could be going to paying goods increase. Or paying rent and groceries. And it's clear that Trump's trade wars are hurting American families. Yet all we have to show for the economic pain are news reports of these flimsy trade deals.
There's a lot to unpack with this. The main point I wanted to get to is how the administration seems to be saying that these one-time price shocks that come from the tariffs is not inflation. And someone may scratch their head and say, how can a price increase not be inflationary? So, David Meyer, can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's kind of like we're splitting hairs here, because on one hand, the Congresswoman is completely correct. As prices rise, that is inflation. However, if prices rise and then that price increase stops, the rate of price increase stops, there's no more inflation. But that doesn't mean things aren't more expensive. It's just that we journeyed from one price level to another price level. Using a term that probably a lot of listeners are familiar with, you probably hear about something called the CPI, the Consumer Price Index. So we measure inflation by looking at the rate of increase in the Consumer Price Index. So the Secretary of Treasury is probably referencing something like, well, we went from, you know, CPI of, and I'm making these numbers up, 100 to 110, and then the number stayed at 110. Well, that would indicate somewhere along the line, we experienced 10% inflation, which is quite high, and then prices stabilized. So yes, you can have a one-time increase in the price level. That does not promise ongoing inflation. However, while that price level was increasing, that is inflation.
And the concern is that there could be runaway inflation where you have salaries are now increasing in order to keep up with inflation. Therefore, that drives inflation and things get out of control. And I guess that's what the distinction that we're hearing from the administration.
Well, and also, I think probably, and I don't, I'm not I have no insight into the administration's thinking here, but what I would say is that inflation and having a good understanding of it also is, it's important to distinguish what's causing the inflation. Is the inflation being caused by a increase in producer costs? In which case, that type of inflation tends to be self-limiting, as opposed to an inflation that's created by cheap credit.
Or a monetary policy. Dumping too much currency into the economy.
Right. Dumping too much money, chasing too few goods.
Right. And so that's where they're saying, this is not inflation. This is just prices are going up, but this is not inflation. And that seems contradictory.
Right. And it seems contradictory, but once again, it's not, because inflation is dynamic. It's ongoing. Whereas when we say that the price increased, we're just saying that the price went from one level to the next. And when it is at that next level, the inflation has stopped. It's no longer moving up.
Right. But what's moving up is what you're paying at the grocery counter. You know, you're going through that checkout line and you're feeling the pain. So, all of these things end up at the kitchen table eventually. And we're trying to break down all this economic yik-yak coming from Washington, D.C. and across the country from all these pointy-headed people. So economics for plain English, everything you wanted to know about economics, but you were afraid to ask, give us a call. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In order to keep up what's happening in the economy and in the news, it helps to have a pretty good understanding, or even just a regular understanding of the complex terminology used to describe what's happening in our economy. The book Economics in Plain English breaks it all down, breaks down these terms, gives examples and what they mean. This is a way to arm you against some of the flim-flam that's being passed off as economic analysis that we're getting from Washington, D.C., from both sides of the aisle at times. David A. Mayer is the author of the book. David, I'm going to ask you about modern monetary theory, MMT. Some people call it magical monetary theory, people who look down on this idea. You don't really hear the term a lot in news, but you kind of hear some people allude to it. I think they're afraid to say the words. And so this is the idea that the currency, the inflationary conduct that we get is driven actually not against the value of the currency, but by the economic productivity of the overall economy. And this is why President Biden was able to produce billions, trillions of dollars for economic development for things like the chips and other infrastructure ideas. He's saying we're growing the economy, therefore we're able to produce, print out extra money in order to do this because it will pay for itself, essentially. Is that right?
I think you have a pretty good grasp on the concept, but ultimately the danger is that the real economy, goods, services, jobs, is what really matters. And the danger, and I think we've experienced it, is that this loose credit, over the top government spending in the form of transfer payments and things like that, leads itself to inflation. The inflation that we've experienced over the last few years has really a direct result of the federal government being far too willing to spend in terms of stimulus checks and things during the pandemic.
Wall Street bailouts.
Yes. It's all around. It's not just households. It's firms as well. Lost my train of thought there for a second.
But the thing is that the government is, or the Federal Reserve, we should say, is producing more and more money, or they're adding it on their sheets. But where does it come from? It just comes from the idea that we're going to add more zeros onto these sheets.
So the way the Fed increases its balance sheet, right, is by going out into the market and purchasing. It has to purchase assets from dealers. And so what the Federal Reserve has done since the financial crisis has been to increase the size of what's called our monetary base, bank reserves. What used to be measured in the tens of billions over the last 20 years is now measured in the trillions of dollars. And so we have a large amount of bank reserves in our system right now. Now, what's holding that from leaking out into the general economy and causing kind of widespread monetary inflation or hyperinflation is the fact that the Federal Reserve, acting independently of the political process, is able to rein in the ability of banks to lend all of those reserves. So yes, there is a much larger monetary base. There is a much larger money supply than what we once had before 2008. but at the same time, there are some limits on that. What I'm referring to is really the ability of government to spend without considering the idea that too much debt is actually a problem. And we're starting to see it. It's the problem of the debt is starting to become apparent in the way that things are shaping up. For instance, when it comes to a reserve currency in the world, the euro used to be the second largest reserve currency. It's now being replaced by gold. And what that tells me is that central banks and investors are starting to question the safety and security,
the stability, the reliability
of the system.
Yeah.
Yes.
So there's this capital flight to trying to find where can I put my money so that I know that it's safe.
Right. And so right now the dollar still maintains about half of overall, if you look at all the world and you look at reserves all around the world, the dollar represents about half of those reserves.
Right. So we can see who the drug dealers and people like that, where are they putting their money in order to make sure that it's still there. Some people are arguing that the fact that the economy has not collapsed, that this is the triumph of modern monetary theory. That seems to be kind of like, well, maybe, but who's to say it won't collapse?
Yeah, I mean, look, if you're driving a car down the road and you go off a cliff, it's not really bad until you actually hit the bottom of the ravine.
Unscheduled, so, spontaneous disassembly.
Right. So it is easy to make pronouncements like that, that yes, this must be working, but we don't know. In explaining the economy, right, a nice way to think about our economy is this, and how it works, is that it's like being in a car, okay? And you, the average person at your home, you represent the driver of this vehicle, and all of the decisions you make have an impact on the overall economy. But you got some problems. For instance, instead of a nice windshield, we've replaced it with plywood. You can't see out the front window. You can only see out the rear view. Over to your right next to you, you have the Federal Reserve just kind of gently telling you, you know, here's what we think is going on. And in the backseat, you have 535 members of Congress, the Senate, and plus one, the President of the United States, all wanting to jump in that front seat with you and help you drive your car and mash that gas pedal. And so when we make pronouncements about, we've reached this new phase in our economy where you can just spend, and it's not going to have an impact later on, none of us can see the future. And that's the real issue. And so that makes the drive quite scary.
Let's go to a caller. Our number is 833-877-8255. If you've got a question or a comment about our economy, about terms that we use, do you think they're trying to do this in a way to, you know, baffle us so that we don't know what's happening? Let's go to Randall. Randall, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay, well, now I have two questions, and you can take them in any order. But the first question is, based on the analogy you just gave with all these people in the car, who's paying attention to the blind spot? That's what I want to know. Second of all, there was a great story on NPR, probably more than 10 years ago, it was a biologist or somebody, talking about how when the question was like, when the human species dies out, what will become the dominant species on Earth? And I think the answer was rats. So following that model, right now, and for many decades, the U.S. dollar has sort of been the dominant currency on Earth. It's sort of what everything else is tracked to. But if or even when the U.S. dollar falls from that number one spot, what's most likely going to take its place?
All right, Randall, thank you for that. So the blind spot, I guess that's the economists. They're the ones who are watching for the blind spot.
Right. And the way you do that is by collecting data through surveys, right? And trying to gather a picture of what's going on. And you do that by talking to a lot of people. But with all of that being said, it's not that we just have a blind spot in the car. Remember, we can't even see out the front windshield. So a lot of times we're flying blind and we're flying on data that is lagging what's actually happening.
And so, they don't want to have the brakes ever applied. They want to remove the brake pedal. The brake pedal would be higher interest rates.
Right. And so if you remember, I don't know how many of you remember from driver's ed ever being in a car where the driver's ed instructor had the brake on the passenger side. That's what the Fed does have. They have the ability to hit that brake. And so you've got a lot of noise in the economy and trying to get the clear signals to figure out what policy decision to make. What do we do with interest rates, for instance, means filtering through that noise and listening to a bunch of different voices. And so that doesn't preclude that there's blind spots, because there are. There's assumptions in our thinking that we totally miss. Think of the financial crisis. One of the beliefs was the market builds in price of everything you can possibly think of. Well, it didn't build into its prices the idea that we were maybe securitizing loans and then insuring them, hoping that they were all good. And we had trust in a system that completely collapsed in 2008. So yeah, we don't really know our blind spots until they make it clear to us that was a blind spot.
Right, we don't know we're in a bubble until it bursts. Okay, we're gonna take a break here. Our phone lines are open. If you got a question, a comment, anything about economics that you've been wondering about but you've been afraid to ask, now's your opportunity. So often we're being told things about the economy that are just not true. And this is being used by both sides for political opportunism. So how do we cut through all that and find out what is working, what is not, and what should be your next move when it comes to your personal finance? The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues right after this. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Economics in Plain English is a new book by David A. Mayer. And we're taking your questions and calls, 833-877-8255. So really quickly, to circle back to Randall, which currency could take the place of the U.S. dollar? We do know that the dollar is weakened. It's not so it's the, what do they call it, the DXY, the U.S. dollar index, says it's hovering around 98.6, its lowest point in nearly 3 years. It's considered kind of a weak dollar right now. What does that mean? And we hear that all the time. The dollar is strong, and you think that's a good idea, but maybe not so much.
Yeah, you really should not have any kind of emotional reaction to the strength or weakness of the dollar unless you are on a vacation to Europe. Strong dollar, weak dollar really just means there's different sets of winners and losers. A strong dollar is good if you are an importer, for instance, and you're seeking to get as much or as many foreign goods as possible, right? A weak dollar is good if you're an exporter and you're trying to sell things abroad. And so the relative strength or weakness of the dollar is not something that should alarm us. As a matter of fact, when our economy is doing really well, one of the things that happens is the dollar weakens. Why? Because if the economy is doing well, we're shopping more often. And when we shop, we tend to buy things from other places. And that means supplying our currency in the foreign exchange market, driving down the exchange rate. And so this strong dollar, weak dollar, which can oftentimes be can sound kind of scary, right, is really something we shouldn't even have I wouldn't lose a lot of sleep over it.
Similarly, we also have an obsession with the strength of the highs and lows of the stock market. And so, you know, when the stock market is doing, you know, high selling numbers are huge, people tend to think that's a good thing. Not necessarily so. We hear it all the time on the program Marketplace that the stock market is not the economy. So why do we care so much about the stock market?
Well, the stock market underlies a lot of the emotion that consumers feel and investors. And so when the market is strong, people have a lot of confidence and they tend to spend more because of this confidence. Also, most of us at some point are going to have some type of savings, which will probably be invested in the market in through a 401k or a pension plan, 403bs, things like that. And so what happens when the market is doing well, it shows us that our assets, the value of our investment portfolios, are higher. And that tends to allow us to spend more and not have to save as much because the value of our financial assets is growing. And then when that market crashes, even if we don't lose our jobs and we keep working, we probably will spend less money in order to rebuild our financial assets, to rebuild our balance sheet, for instance.
But there are times when the stock market goes up and it's because corporations are doing these massive stock buybacks. It's not an
in which case that's right. That's just a false signal, right? Like someone's boosting the price.
Yeah. Or they're manipulating the price or, you know, sure. That happens. Seems like, you know, we're seeing stocks fluctuate all the time right now. Especially with what's happening with this tariff stuff.
Yes, I agree. The volatility right now in the market is extremely high. I think that there's a lot of people around the world that don't really know, including myself. I don't know what's going to happen next. I can't tell you what's going to happen next. But referring back to my earlier analogy, we have a very chaotic group of people that are trying to climb into that front seat. And they're messing with the gas pedal and they're messing with the steering. And what that's doing is it's creating a lot of fear, a lot of uncertainty for people.
All right. I'm going to go to Jennifer on the phones. And Jennifer, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just wondering, recently in May, the Moody's rating of the U.S. credit was downgraded. And I'm just... For all my Google research and everything, I just don't know exactly what that means, and especially how it translates to, you know, the U.S. consumer.
Great question, Jennifer. Thank you. You're on the and so David.
Yeah. So U.S. Treasury bonds were downgraded. So instead of being the very best, safest investment you can have, they were downgraded to a level just below that. So still a very safe investment. A large amount of wealth around the world is in the form of that particular investment. I want to say that the decision to downgrade that is based on the fact that we don't really have a solid fiscal plan. The Big Beautiful Bill, for instance, which promises increases in spending and at the same time decreases in taxes to a government that is already running a very large deficit and has accumulated a large national debt, doesn't inspire a lot of confidence in the Treasury. And so that would be behind that downgrade. Now, the other rating agencies had downgraded the Treasury much earlier. So, but at the end of the day, you don't have a lot of options in terms of some other type of highly liquid investment that you can go to. The Treasury is kind of it. And so, I don't know that at the end of the day that it really makes a big difference for the average consumer. But it is cause for concern and it is something that we should pay attention to.
The government is basically crowding out all the other competitors for credit.
Yes. Yes.
So that makes things more expensive.
Well, it makes it more expensive for other investments to take place. Now that hadn't been an issue going for since World War II. That hadn't really been an issue in our country because one of the things that has often offset the reason we haven't really seen crowding out is because since the end of the war, the U.S. has experienced a pretty steady inflow of savings from abroad. Since the dollar is the reserve currency in the world, since the dollar is what most oil, regardless of who's producing it, is bought and sold, there are a lot of dollars overseas flowing into the United States that help to keep our interest rates relatively low.
So like when Argentina, they're using the dollar basically as their currency rather than their own, that helps our economy.
Well, it provides because the only way a dollar is useful is if eventually it returns to the US and purchases either our goods and services or purchases our real or financial assets.
Okay. And so then why is the reserve currency so successful then? Because people are using our dollars and they're stuffing their mattresses with it in Buenos Aires.
Well, if they are stuffing their mattresses with it, it's probably has more to do with them being fearful of what's going to happen in Argentina, not so much with what's going to happen in the United States.
So you teach at a high school here in San Antonio as well, right?
Yeah, I used to teach at Churchill High School in San Antonio. And after that was a school administrator. But my role in economics mainly is as a teacher to students, but over the last 20 years, more so as a teacher to other teachers. I work with the College Board, helping to train economics teachers all over the world to get students to understand principles of economics at the college level. So kind of your basic microeconomics, basic macroeconomics that you took in college.
Well, the reason I asked you is because I'm really interested in what young people are thinking about the economy and about their future.
Well, I don't have a good insight into today's young people and what they see in the economy, but I do know from my experience in the classroom that there's a lot of sense of not knowing how they fit in. And I think that's probably not, you know, unique to this particular generation, but it's just kind of part of growing up, right? How do I fit into this whole thing? And what I want students to understand is that all of us are part of the economy and we play that role in the economy all the time. We're in the job market, we're shopping, we're buying things. So we are engaged in the economy. I would argue that we are engaged in the economy far more often than we're engaged in the political process. Even though the political process and politics gets the lion's share of the news and the opinions, I would argue that really it's the economy and economics that you're more likely to be dealing with on a day-to-day basis. And so allowing students to access economic language that we use and understand what's being said and starting to relate that to what their very own decisions that they're already making. Now we're just giving them verbiage that they can use to describe what it is they're doing. You know, they
didn't just I think get people a have job. A pretty good sense of what's going on. And so, yeah, like you said, they just don't have the vocabulary.
Right, right. And then, of course, the other concern is that do we really mean the same thing? For instance, if, you know, circling back to our discussion on unemployment and joblessness not being the same.
All right, well, we're out of time. The bells tell us that. Economics in Plain English by David A. Mayer is the book. I think this is a book that I think it should be in every newsroom, especially to break down the complex goings-on for our listeners. And David, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.